Please turn in your Bibles to Psalm 139. We continue this morning with our little series on familiar psalms, psalms that we're familiar with, but perhaps we don't understand them as well as we think. Last week was Psalm 23, which Charles Spurgeon called the pearl of the psalms, and this week it's Psalm 139. Which Spurgeon called the sapphire of the psalms. So let us hear this sapphire of a psalm. To the choirmaster, a psalm of David. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down, and are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. You hem me in, behind and before, and lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high, I cannot attain it. Where shall I go from your spirit, or where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me and the light about me be night. Even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as the day, for darkness is as light with you. For you formed my inward parts, you knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there were none of them. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I would count them, they are more than the sand. I awake and I am still with you. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. O men of blood, depart from me. They speak against you with malicious intent. Your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? And do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with complete hatred. I count them my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. And see if there be any grievous way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. Psalm 139 is like a good fiction thriller, or a good movie thriller. You know the kind of book or movie I'm talking about? The kind where you think you know what's going on, and then you get to the end. And having read or watched to the end, you realize you need to go back and reread the book or rewatch the movie all over again in order to properly understand it. Because the end explains the beginning and everything in between. Well, that's like Psalm 139. The end, verses 19 to 24, explains the beginning and everything in between, verses 1 to 18. But when you read this psalm without the end in mind, when you only read up to verse 18, as we normally do, let's be honest, then we don't really see what this psalm is about, because in the end, David wants vindication in a world of sin. He is surrounded by wicked people, and he wants to be vindicated. But we tend to view this psalm as a psalm primarily and only of comfort. God knows us. And at one level, we wouldn't be wrong. The main section of this psalm, verses 1 to 18, contains three wonderful truths that comfort us. First, there is the truth that God knows us completely. God knows us completely, verses 1 to 6. It begins with a very personal statement directed to God himself. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. And then David unpacks that statement in different ways in verses 2 to 5. God knows our actions in the home, verse 2. You know when I sit and when I rise up. He knows our thoughts in our minds, verse 2. You discern my thoughts from afar. He knows our movements in the street. You search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. He knows our words on our tongues. Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it all together. The pairs of words that David uses here to describe what God knows shows the comprehensive nature of what he knows. Did you notice he uses opposites to convey the whole? Verse 2, he knows our sitting and our rising. Verse 3, he knows our walking and our resting, our lying down, which means he knows everything in between those two opposites. And then notice the variety of verbs that he uses to describe how God knows us. You have searched me. You know me. You discern my thoughts. You search out my ways. You are acquainted with all of my ways. You know the words on my tongue. So it is a comprehensive knowledge. God knows us completely. But it's also a prior knowledge. It's an instantaneous prior knowledge, verse 4. Even before a word is on my tongue, you know it. In other words, God's knowledge of us does not evolve. It doesn't progress. God doesn't know as we grow. We mustn't think that God learns things. Boys and girls, you know, when you go to nursery or primary school or at home, somebody teaches you your letters and your phonetics and your spelling and your numbers and your multiplication table. Well, God has never learnt any of those. God doesn't learn anything. He always knows everything. Instantaneously. God has never grown in his knowledge of anything. God knows the end from the beginning, and that is why when we utter a word, or before we utter a word, he knows it already. His knowledge is an already instantaneous knowledge of everything. It's also an inescapable knowledge, verse 5. You hem me in behind and before and lay your hand upon me. You cannot escape God's knowledge of you because he hems you in behind and before. And no wonder David concludes this section, verse 6, such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain it. It is so high that David cannot understand it, but it is still wonderful for David that God knows him completely. That is the first comfort. God knows us completely. Second, God surrounds us entirely. verses 7 to 12. God surrounds us entirely. Just like with the first section, the first verse here, verse 7, makes a general point, and then the rest of the section unpacks the general point. Verse 7, where shall I go from your spirit? Or where shall I flee from your presence? And then David gives a number of examples of trying to flee from God's presence. If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, the grave where the dead go, you are there. Again, notice the opposites to communicate the whole. Heaven above, Sheol below. It is two places outside this physical, visible world. God is there. But he's not just in the heavens above and in the grave below. He's also present in this world in two extreme opposites. Verse 9. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me and your right hand shall hold me. The wings of the morning refers to the east where the sun rises. The uttermost parts of the sea refer to the west, the bit beyond the Mediterranean. The wings of the morning give this picture of the sun rising in the east and flapping its way across the sky to the uttermost parts of the sea where it sets. But the verse is not just speaking about geography. It's also speaking about the speed of light. Traveling on the wings of the morning means that David pictures himself traveling with the sun at the speed of light. And what happens when you travel at the speed of light from east to west? You find that God got there ahead of you. He got there ahead of you because he was already there. His knowledge is an already knowledge, and his presence is an already presence. He's there waiting for you. Do you see the comfort? With his hand to lead you, to hold you. What a beautiful picture. There's nowhere on this earth that we cannot go where God is not there already before us. If you travel on the wings of the sun, then you travel by day, by night, by light, and God is there during the day wherever it is you go. But what about the dark? If he's there in the light, what about the dark? If God dwells in light, not darkness, and if, verse 11, the darkness covers us, can we then evade God's presence in the dark? Boys and girls, I don't know about you, but sometimes when I was growing up, now this is a big secret, boys and girls, this is between you and me and nobody else in this room. But when I was growing up, sometimes I was a little bit scared of the dark. My two brothers were more scared of it, but I was just a little bit scared of it. And what did I do when I was scared of the dark? Well, I would call for my mummy or my daddy. And what would they do? They would come into the room and they would put a little light on in the dark. That's what comforts us, because we can't see in the dark. You're looking in the dark for your teddy. You're looking in the dark for your duvet. You see something in the room that scares you because you're in the dark. The question is, boys and girls, can God see in the dark? Your parents need to put the light on when they come into your dark room. Does God need to put a light on? Listen to these words. Even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as the day, for darkness is as light to you. God doesn't need to put the light on in the dark, because the darkness is like the light to him. Darkness and light, in this agree, great God, they both are alike to thee. Thine hand pierces thy foes as soon through midnight shades as well as blazing noon. God sees in the dark. It's why we can't escape him in the dark. So you see this comprehensive nature of God's presence with us. He surrounds us entirely. Whether you go to the heavens or down to Sheol, whether you go to the east or to the west, whether you wrap yourselves in a duvet of darkness, he is there. He sees. And it's a wonderful comfort, isn't it? Boys and girls, when you go to nursery this week, or you go to your classroom or your study room at home, God is there. Young people, when you go to your classroom this week, or students to your college hall, God is there. When you go to that boardroom this week at work for that difficult meeting, God is there. When you go to the delivery ward, or the surgeon's table, or the GP's waiting room, God is there. He got there before you. It's a beautiful thing to know that God surrounds us entirely. Those are the two great truths that David starts with. God knows us completely, and he surrounds us entirely. And it's those two truths are based on another third great truth. God made us wonderfully. Verses 13 to 18. God knows us completely. God surrounds us entirely because, notice the four at the beginning of verse 13, because he made us wonderfully. And that four connects verses 13 to 18 with verses 1 to 12. But it connects most immediately to verses 11 and 12. Just glance back at the passage. We've just learnt that there is nowhere God is not present, where God cannot see us, even in the dark. And now David gives us proof. God made us in the dark. But where is one of the darkest places on earth? In a mother's womb. There is no light in a mother's womb. It's pitch darkness. You know, modern medicine can do these amazing things, even to a baby in a womb. If a baby's got a problem, sometimes a surgeon can go in and with keyhole surgery operate on that baby in the womb. But what does the surgeon need? Needs a torch. Needs a light. Because he can't operate in a womb. Because it's pitch darkness. But look at what God does in the dark. He stitched us together in our mother's womb. In the dark. Because it was God doing it and not nature acting upon nature, we are fearfully and wonderfully made. This is not blind, evolutionary, natural process. No, we are products of a careful sewing job done by a God who is not blind. A God who sees, even in the dark. No wonder David bursts into praise at this point. Verse 14, I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. And the point he has been making about God seeing in the dark continues in verse 15. My frame was not hidden from you in the dark when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Notice the language of seeing. Our frames were not hidden. Our unformed substance was seen by God. Why did he see it? Because he was there, doing it, in the dark. This is the foundation for God knowing us completely and surrounding us entirely. God made us wonderfully, beautifully, in the dark. He made us. But he didn't just make us, he also made our days. Did you notice that in verse 16? In your book were written, every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there were none of them. God forms our unformed substance, and he forms our days in which we are to live. All of them, before they come to be, from embryonic stage to elderly age, God has marked out every single day for us. This is why abortion at one end of life is wrong. And it's why euthanasia at the other end of life is wrong. Because both interrupt and terminate God's personal creation project. It is God who made us. And it is God who made the days in which we are to live. And no human being has the right to take those away from another human being when it is God who gave them to them. Well, David bursts into praise again in verse 17. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I would count them, they are more than the sand. I awake and still I am with you. The very last line of verse 18, it's a bit of a surprise, isn't it? Given that the psalm so far has been saying that you are with me, now it says, I awake and I am with you. It's a bit of a surprise, isn't it? You'd expect, I awake and still you are with me. You haven't gone anywhere because you surround me. But no, David has shifted it. I am now with you. Well, I think there's the hint here of a resurrection. I awake. The movement of the psalm is from God coming to be with us, to us awakening and going to be with God. It's as if we fall asleep in the last ordained day of our life on this earth, and then we awake to the first day of the next life in God's presence. I am now with you. So from the beginning of our unformed substance to the resurrection of our bodies into God's paradise presence, God knows us completely. He surrounds us entirely because he made us wonderfully. And he made all our days, the good ones and the bad ones, the happy ones and the sad ones, the busy ones and the quiet ones. He made every day that you live through. So these are the three wonderful truths that we learn. God knows us completely. He surrounds us entirely because he made us wonderfully. Aren't those three beautiful truths for us this morning? Aren't those three wonderful comforts? God knows all about us. He is all around us because he made us. And then you get to verse 19, and it feels like David spoils the sapphire. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. O men of blood, depart from me. They speak against you with malicious intent. Your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? Do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with complete hatred. I count them my enemies. Let's be honest. We wish David had put that in another psalm. Wouldn't it be beautiful to just end at verse 18? We don't know the exact context of these verses, but clearly David is wrestling with the problem of people in a world that oppose God. There are bloodthirsty men. There are people who speak maliciously against God, who take his name in vain. There are enemies of God. And David is clearly on God's side, not theirs. Verse 21, he hates those who hate God. Verse 22, God's enemies have become his enemies. So David is not in a moral fix here. He's not wondering, which side am I on in this world? He knows he's on God's side. And yet, he's not self-righteous about it. He's not on some holier-than-thou pedestal. Verse 23. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. And see if there be any grievous way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. David knows he's on God's side in a world full of sin, but he also knows that that world full of sin can just as easily be on the inside of himself. Hence why he prays, search me, O God, and know my heart. Did you notice David picks up the vocabulary from earlier in the psalm? Search me connects with verse 1. You, O Lord, have searched me. Know my heart connects with verse 1. You have known me. You know when I sit and when I rise. Know my thoughts connects with verse 2. You discern my thoughts from afar. See if there's any grievous way in me. Connects with verse 3, you are acquainted with all my ways. The crossover in vocabulary makes us ask ourselves if we do not need to go back and reread this psalm from the beginning and see if we've actually understood it properly the first time. Remember I said that the psalm is like a thriller, a book thriller or a movie thriller. You have to read and watch to the end to understand the beginning and everything in between. And having read to the end of the psalm, we see that David takes God's side in a world full of sin, a world opposed to God, and yet he is fully aware of his own heart that needs to be searched. These final verses put a different spin on those three truths that we found this morning. If we look at this psalm carefully, there is ambiguity in some of what David says. It could be read as a comfort, and it could also be read as a challenge. This psalm in verses 1 to 18 can disturb as well as comfort. Let me show you the terms and the phrases that are ambiguous that could be read to comfort or to disturb. Verse 2 and 4, God knows our every thought and every word. Are you happy with that? The thoughts that you hide from your spouse, from your mum, from your dad, are you happy that God knows those? God knows exactly where we go, verse 3. Can feel a bit like a big brother house. Cameras everywhere. Verse 5, God hems us in behind and before. Can feel a bit claustrophobic. The hand upon us feels a bit like an invasion into our personal space. In verse 6, the word wonderful in Hebrew can just as easily be translated difficult. Such knowledge is too difficult for me. I can't handle that you know everything about me. It's too difficult to bear, God. In verse 7, the mention of fleeing suggests David might actually want to get away from God, like Adam and Eve in the garden when God came walking. Verse 10, God's right hand is a sign of power and authority. He judges with his right hand. Verse 11, the darkness covering him could sound like David wants the darkness to cover him, to swallow him up. This word cover is the word used in Genesis 3:15 of bruising, of crushing. Verse 13, he formed our inward parts, which means he formed our conscience. He gave us a conscience. So do those things comfort you or disturb you? When God invades your privacy, how does it feel? Well, I guess it all comes down to what kind of a person you are this morning. Innocent or guilty? A person in a relationship of grace with God, or a person in a relationship of works with God? Because if you are the latter, if you are guilty here this morning, if this morning you are a hypocrite, if you lead a double life, if you have a secret addiction to eating or drinking or porn or fantasizing about the guy at work, if you have a secret, intimate text messaging relationship with someone that is inappropriate, then this psalm should disturb you. It should unsettle you. It should convict you. Because God knows. He knows what goes on behind closed doors. He knows your thoughts when your eyes wander. He knows where you go when your family and college friends don't know where you go. He knows what's under your breath, spoken that no one else hears. Whatever it is you do, whatever it is, or wherever it is you do it, God knows it. He is watching because he sees even in the dark. He knows us completely. He surrounds us entirely because he made us. And what this psalm says to us this morning is, if you are a sinner, a hypocrite, a pretender, a double living person, there is no refuge from this God. He knows all about you. And there is judgment for such people. And what God says to us in this psalm this morning is, stop pretending. I know you completely. Stop running. I surround you entirely. Stop hiding in the dark. Darkness is as light to me. Stop. Surrender. Because there's no escape from our Creator. But here's the wonderful thing this morning. The God who has chased us all through life is not there to condemn us, but to forgive us. I don't know if you're familiar with Francis Thompson's famous poem, The Hound of Heaven, 182-line poem written in the late 19th century. It's about a hound, a dog, chasing a hare, a rabbit. But it is really an analogy of God chasing a lost sinner. The poem starts like this, from the perspective of the hare. I fled him down the nights and down the days. I fled him down the arches of the years. I fled him down the labyrinthine ways of my own mind and in the midst of tears. I hid from him and under running laughter. And the final stanza ends like this. Halts by me that footfall is my gloom after all. Shade of his hand outstretched caressingly. Ah, fondest, blindest, weakest, I am he whom thou seekest. Thou drovest love from me, from thee, who drovest me. In other words, when the hound finally catches the hare, the shade of the hound's outstretched hand is not oppressive. It is caressive. The hound of heaven is the God of grace. God does not hound us to pound us. He doesn't hem us to condemn us. He hounds us and hems us. He pursues us and chases us so that we might surrender and find comfort when we've been craving comfort in all the wrong places. There is no refuge from this God, but there is refuge in this God. That's why this morning, if you're here this morning and you are a sinner and you are guilty, then those are the words you need to pray. Search me, O God, and know my heart. I'm guilty. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. And when you do that, this psalm no longer disturbs. It begins to comfort. You may say, well, how do I move from this psalm disturbing me to comforting me? Well, we need to be connected to the only person who could pray the prayer at the end of this psalm and not be afraid of being found out, because he had nothing to hide. And that person is Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ sung Psalm 139. He prayed the prayer at the end of Psalm 139. And he fulfilled Psalm 139. During his temptations, it was as if Jesus said to God, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. See if there's any grievous way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." When the devil tempted Jesus, God was testing the heart of his son. And what did he find in it? Not a grievous way, which can be translated an idolatrous way. He didn't find Jesus worshipping someone else. He found Jesus with a heart of full, pure, perfect devotion to his God. He found a man who walked in the way everlasting. In Eden, God searched the heart of his son Adam, and he found sin and idolatry. At Sinai, God searched the heart of his son Israel, and he found sin and idolatry. And in the wilderness, God searched the heart of Jesus Christ, and he found love and obedience and perfect worship. Here is someone who could sing this psalm and find only comfort in it. Which means that if we want to be comforted this morning, we need to get connected to the person who this psalm is all about. Because Jesus was the perfect psalm singer. God searched his heart, his thoughts, his words, his deeds, and he found nothing to condemn. And the good news of the gospel, friends, this morning, is that if you believe in Jesus Christ, his thoughts and words and deeds become yours. And your thoughts and words and deeds are laid on him at the cross when he dies. He receives the punishment for us failing to keep this psalm. And we receive the benefits of him succeeding in keeping this psalm. I said at the beginning that if we want to understand Psalm 139 properly, then we need to read it to the very end. Because the end explains the beginning and everything in between. Well, Psalm 139 doesn't end with verses 19 to 24. It ends with the person of Jesus Christ. And when you get to that end of Psalm 139, then it is indeed a comfort, because we stand this morning accepted by God, and the knowledge that he knows us completely surrounds us entirely, because he made us wonderfully, is a comfort. But it is only a comfort because we're connected to the man who kept this psalm for us.